crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're joined by the acclaimed author and historian, Peter Kuznick. Peter Kuznick is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. On today's show, Peter Kuznick will talk to us about his recent travels abroad to Europe and to Russia. He'll also talk to us about the forthcoming update to The Untold History of the United States, where he's doing a new chapter on the last 6 years. Today on the Project Censored Show for the hour, historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are honored and delighted to welcome back to the show Professor Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and he is also co-author with Oliver Stone of the best-selling book, The Untold History of the United States. That, of course, is also a series that was on Showtime and is available on Netflix. And it is, of course, a massive coup d'etat of sorts, pedagogically speaking, that Peter and Oliver were able to get this information out to the mass public, to general audiences. And I know I have adopted this in my history courses, my modern U.S. history courses, and I know many others who have, and it is an absolutely incredible teaching tool. And Peter Kuznick, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Mickey, for that very wonderful introduction.
And by the way, listeners can learn more at untoldhistory.com. And Peter Kuznick, you've got some great news for us. This book came out several years ago. In fact, it's, what is it now? Been 5, 6 years?
It's been 6 years now, yeah.
I remember when it came out, time certainly flies. And as historians know, things change. So you have been recently involved in doing an update of sorts to The Untold History of the United States, which, by the way, is over 700 pages. And I know that when we've spoken to you before, you've talked about how you even had to cut some things out of it because it was, you know, it was such an endeavor covering much of the 20th century and now into the 21st. So tell us what you've been working on lately.
Well, Oliver and I are putting out a new, revised, updated edition of The Untold History of the United States. That we're adding a chapter that's going to cover the period from 2012 to 2018. We're almost finished. We're very close. It's going to be long. There's so much has happened between 2012 and 2018 that is very, very hard to be succinct. The original book in English was almost 800 pages. I think we're now going to be around 900 pages, which is not a problem with the U.S. book because they use fairly light paper. But if you try to pick up our Russian volume, which is about 1,000 pages, or our Spanish edition, which is already about 1,200 pages, they're almost impossible to lift. One of the groups that responded very positively originally was this thread of bodybuilders. I always had the assumption that they were using our book, especially the Spanish version, for weightlifting. So now we're coming out with a new one. In addition to that, we've got volume 2 of the 4 volumes of our young readers book for middle school students is going to be coming out in October, and we're making a lot of progress on the graphic novel. Eric Singer has been adapting the young readers book.
Exciting.
They did a terrific job on volume 2.
Yeah, that's a very exciting prospect, getting this out into middle schools, right, for younger people. And is it Paul Buell that's doing the graphic?
No, but Paul has been a good advisor to our project and has given us some good suggestions. But no, he's not directly involved in that way. Stephen Stiles and Scott Cunningham are doing the graphic.
When might that be out?
It'll be out next year. I don't think we're going to be able to get that out in 2018. So I'm looking for that in 2019.
Well, we'll certainly circle back around when the graphic version comes out. That will be another fantastic audience to reach out to.
Paul Buell was actually involved in the graphic novel version of Howard Zinn's People's History, and that has sold 75,000 or 85,000 copies. So it's a good way to reach a different demographic, and we're trying to reach them all.
Well, that's what's so fantastic about the work that you and Oliver have been doing. And, of course, the fact that this was a film documentary, you know, just opened it up literally to millions of people who otherwise, as you say, unless they were bodybuilders or PhD candidates, might not have picked up a book of this size.
The book is out in about 20 different languages. The documentary is aired in almost every country across the globe. So it's been seen in one form or read in one form or another by scores of millions of people, which is the great thing about working with Oliver. Not only his insight, not only his directing skill, not only his historical knowledge, but the fact that you know how it is with you and I are historians, and we don't usually reach mass audiences of scores of millions of people. So this is a great opportunity, and Oliver and I are trying to take advantage of it. If you look at the way the world has gone in the last 6 years, from 2012 to 2018, you might say that we weren't nearly as successful as we hoped to be. But on the other hand, maybe we could take a little bit of credit for things that have not gone completely off the tracks. But the world has gotten a lot more dangerous now than it was back when we wrote this and we produced the original series. And you look at the change. We begin the new chapter by talking about Putin's State of the Nation address in Russia on March 1st of this year, in which he lays out that Russia has now developed 5 new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent the United States' ballistic missile defense system. Putin, as he explains very, very clearly there, and the Russians overall have been very concerned, not only about America's missile defense, but going back to 2002, when the United States abrogated the ABM treaty. They saw that as a really important turning point. So you've got that in 2002. You've got the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. You've got the invasion of Iraq in 2003. You've got the continuing expansion of NATO during that period. But the United States initially was feeling very, very potent and empowered. And by 2003, in anticipation of the invasion of Iraq, things looked like they were going very well in Afghanistan at that point. And you have all the neocons coming out from whatever rock they were hiding under and talking about how proud they were of the American empire. In the past, they would have avoided that term. It was anathema. It was something that one could not discuss in decent, proper company. But by 2003, it was January 5th, 2003, that the New York Times headlined its Sunday magazine section, "American Empire, Get Used to It." And all the leading neocons were now bragging about what a powerful empire this was. And this discussion of unipolarity, that the United States was the unipolar power, goes back to 1991. The recently deceased Charles Krauthammer, as early as 1990 and 1991, started to talk about the United States, that this was a unipolar moment. And then Krauthammer said then that it could last 20 or 30 years. By the early 2000s, Krauthammer had drunken the Kool-Aid and was now saying that he misspoke, that they underestimated the power of the American empire back in 1990 and 1991. It was not a unipolar moment. It was now going to be a unipolar era. Krauthammer says in 2003 that we can't foresee how long this unipolar era could last. By 2005, he had changed his tune completely and says, well, I exaggerated. I was wrong. Things are going so badly now in Iraq and Afghanistan that it's no longer a unipolar era. It's maybe a unipolar moment, and even that's not going to last very, very long.
Well, Peter Kuznick, Francis Fukuyama in The End of History also changed. That was written at the claimed close of the Cold War, right? Some might argue that we've been reigniting the Cold War, or perhaps it didn't finish, or it's Cold War 2.0. But Fukuyama also kind of recanted in a similar way, did he not?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the neocons were so full of themselves that they had this vision, and it was a vision that was laid out pretty clearly by almost every major neocon thinker at the time.
Well, they had their own think tank. They had the Project for the New American Century.
They started that back in 1997, and one of their first items on their agenda was the invasion of Iraq, regime change in Iraq. We've seen how well that's gone. Iran sends us thank you notes every year for turning Iraq over to them and for unleashing the chaos that we're still fighting against, the chaos that we saw with ISIS, the chaos that we've seen with Al-Qaeda, the Nusra Front. And these are all a product of what the United States unleashed with its criminal invasion of Iraq in 2003. But that was part of the game plan.
In 2007, Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, even laid out and said that the plan was to invade seven countries.
Exactly. And high on that list was Syria. If we see what's happening now in Syria, this is not fortuitous. It's not accidental. It was part of their game plan. It was part of their strategy. You know, they had different lists. So it included Libya, which they succeeded in toppling Gaddafi. And we've seen absolute chaos
under Obama. That's under Obama and Hillary Clinton.
That's
State
Obama,
Department.
Exactly. And that spreads to northern Africa as well as in the Middle East. You know, so it was, you had Afghanistan, you had Iraq, you had Syria, you had Libya, you've got Iran. You saw Trump's tweet about Iran and threatening Iran, that Iran is going to suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. So Iran was on the list, Somalia's on the list. The ambitions of these people was unbounded, and they still haven't actually suffered as a result of the chaos that they've unleashed on the planet. They're still influencing. You see them, regular talking heads on MSNBC, on CNN, on Fox. These people, they should pay the price for the havoc that they've wreaked upon people all over the planet. But instead, no, they haven't suffered a bit. Their reputation, they're still considered experts.
Hi, Peter. This is Chase here. I'm wondering what you would think the common thread is amongst those seven countries that the U.S. empire, as we're talking about it, has considered invading. Would it be access to natural resources? What would you say is the common thread in those seven nations?
Well, resources was crucial. It was part of this vision that they had. Clearly, when you're talking about Iraq, you're talking about oil as one of the signs that was popular during the protests and lead up to the Iraq war, said, you know, what is our oil doing under their sand? And so the original idea was we were going to get the Iraqi oil. That has kind of backfired since then. But Iran has oil. Libya has oil. So oil was high on the list, especially for the Bush-Cheney regime that was being run by these oil men. But they saw oil as key to controlling the world, basically. But then there are a lot of other resources. The studies that have come out about Afghanistan and other parts of Central Asia, the studies about the pipelines that they've been envisioning, these are all about economic resources. So high atop the list of the countries that we wanted to overthrow was the U.S. control of those resources. But then there's also the geopolitics. The United States, if you go back to the defense planning guidance of 1992, that the United States had to disavow and walk back because it was so outrageous when it was leaked to the New York Times. That says very clearly that no country should be allowed to emerge that can pose a threat to America's interests, economic and political and military, in any region on the planet. Any regional adversary that can threaten America's interests, whether that's in the Middle East, whether that's in Asia, whether that's in North Asia, any part of Latin America, any adversary that can do that and that can develop weapons of mass destruction should not be allowed to gain that kind of foothold. Very, very clearly stated. That becomes America's official policy under the Bush administration, and we've never backed off of that. So we have our Asia pivot to make sure that China can't pose a threat in the South China Sea or in any part of Asia. We have the confrontation with Korea as it's developing its nuclear weapons. But you look around the planet, Iran seems to be posing a threat. The United States, one of the possibilities, and that seemed to me to be the case, is that Trump wanted to get Korea out of the way so that they could move on Iran. Korea could pose an actual threat. They could counter us. They had, you know, the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, was 35 miles from Seoul, a city that had 25 million people. North Korea had artillery that was trained on Seoul, putting 200,000 Americans also in harm's way, 28,500 American troops in South Korea, and plus the development of their nuclear weapons, and plus delivery systems and ICBMs that could hit continental United States. So we didn't really want to go to war with Korea. The studies that were coming out of Stanford and other places indicated that even if North Korea did not use nuclear weapons, as many as a million people could die in the first days of a war with North Korea. So we didn't really want to go to war with North Korea, although Trump was putting us in a position where that was a possibility. But we are much more willing to go to war with Iran.
I'd like to just remind our listeners very quickly here, Peter. I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. We are joined today by historian Peter Kuznick, who is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. After this musical break, we'll continue our conversation with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. We're joined today by the best-selling author and acclaimed historian from American University, Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. And before the musical break, Peter Kuznick, you were talking about the reasons that the United States has embarked upon these wars. We started the conversation talking about an update to The Untold History coming out this fall. Your work with Oliver Stone is a great in-depth, I wouldn't say an update, it's a more in-depth look at what's going on in the United States in the 20th and 21st century, and of course was accompanied by a fantastic documentary series that listeners can see online on Netflix, Showtime, etc. But Peter Kuznick, you were talking about why the United States planned to go to war in seven countries even before the 9/11 attacks. We were planning on going into Afghanistan and Iraq. Going back to the Bill Clinton Democrat years of the 1990s, we also know that the neocons that we've been talking about, the neocons were lobbying the White House to get into Afghanistan, even sent UNICAL lobbyists over there who happened to be Hamid Karzai. We know what Hamid Karzai later is, trying to get a pipeline to the Caspian Sea, and the Afghans and the Taliban said no. But in Bush-Cheney, the oilmen in the White House, they found people that were much more eager to unveil these imperial plans and construct empire post-9/11, using 9/11 as cover. And in fact, eerily prescient, we were talking about the Project for New American Century. One of the documents they published in 2000 was called Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they named these countries. And they said, absent a catalyzing or catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor, it would likely be difficult to get the American public to go along with such global conquest or such brazen empire. And that's pretty much what you described after 2003, was pretty much the neocons crowing about how we're an empire now, and we basically call the shots as we go.
You know, I'd like to trace it back to a document from 1948 written by George Kennan. Kennan is the architect of the Cold War, really. Kennan was the one who designed containment policy in the original Cold War. And Kennan writes in this secret memo, he says, we've got 6.3% of the world's population, but we consume 15% of the world's wealth. The challenge before us is to maintain this position of disparity, that we cannot help be the object of envy and resentment. And we've got to dispense with ideals. We've got to dispense with principles. We've got to dispense with talk about freedom and democracy. We've got to deal with hard, cold power constructs. And so while this notion of American exceptionalism, the idea that the United States is a gift to humanity, that we just want to spread freedom and democracy, that we're benevolent and altruistic, and we just want to do good in the world, unlike every other country that's motivated by greed or territorial aggrandizement or geopolitics, the United States is different. You know, but what you know and we know is that the United States has not been different, that the United States has been able to project a certain veneer of civility and decency and largesse in the world, but the reality behind the policy has been one of cold, hard greed. And you look at the way the world is structured now, the richest 8 people in the world have more wealth than the poorest 3.6 billion people. In the United States, the richest 3 people have more wealth than the bottom half of the population. A high percentage of Americans can't put their hands on $200 or $500 in an emergency. 20% are living in poverty. Kennan's vision succeeded in ways that Kennan would have deplored and certainly did not countenance. Kennan grew wiser and wiser as the years passed, and he was among those who criticized, denounced the idea of expanding NATO. He said this was going to have terrible consequences in the long run if the United States expands NATO the way we have. The deal that Gorbachev struck in 1990 with Secretary of State Baker and with President Bush was that if he allowed the unification of Germany, NATO would not expand one inch to the east, one thumb's width to the east. NATO has now expanded 13 countries to the east, right up to Russia's doorstep.
But somehow Russia is the aggressor in the region.
Well, this is at the heart of the tension between Russia and the United States and NATO. This is the original sin in some ways that the West committed against Russia. And they could get away with it in the 1990s under Yeltsin. Yeltsin was a fool.
And the United States helped influence that election, speaking of meddling in foreign elections.
Yeltsin was polling at 7% when the United States advisors went in there, and they set up shop in the president's hotel, and they ran his campaign, and they were very open about it. In fact, there's a Hollywood movie that you might have seen called Spinning Boris, which is all about the role that the American advisors played in winning that election for Yeltsin. The person who was way ahead at that point was the communist candidate. History would have been quite different had they won instead of Yeltsin getting back in power. But that period was a disaster for the Russian people. The standard of living plummeted under the shock therapy that American advisors helped impose there. The life expectancy for Russian males dropped from 66 years to 57 years. The economy of Russia shrunk to the size of the Netherlands. This was a disastrous period, which is important for understanding Putin's popularity. How does Putin maintain approval ratings close to 80% still? And it's because the Russian people know what the country was like when Putin came to power in 2000. And Putin has effectively reestablished Russia as a major player on the world scene. And the Russians are a proud people, and they're very nationalistic in many ways. And they want to see their country be a major player, not only in terms of the World Cup and other sporting events, but also in terms of influencing politics. And they've done that. The situation in Syria is certainly a good example. The fact that Netanyahu, of all people, credits Russia with playing a positive, constructive role in the Middle East. When I was last in Moscow for the Victory Day celebrations in May, Netanyahu was there on the viewing stand sitting next to Putin as the parade went by. So Russia has restored its role to some extent, and in some places acts as a positive counterweight to the United States. But we really need to be seeing the United States and Russia working together with China, with Germany, with other countries, but working together to solve some of these very, very serious issues that confront us.
And perhaps President Trump is not the person to do that intellectually, ideologically. Again, there is so much hysteria in the corporate media and coming from halls of government here about Russia. We see sort of a neo-McCarthyite sensibility. We see MSNBC is kind of just foaming at the mouth going on about Russia. And if people don't match the intensity of concern about Russia, they're somehow traitors. Or if they're reporting things like you're talking about, right, it's called fake news. This is a real challenge we have. And as an historian, you've certainly seen other times of hysteria in our history. How do you think this measures what you're seeing right now, given not only your historical background, but the fact that you do travel? And that you were just in Russia a few months ago.
First thing I want to do is send a shout out, Mickey, to you and Chase and Peter and the other folks with Project Censored, because you've been exposing the levels of mendacity and disinformation that is coming out of America's mainstream media. I've never seen anything quite like it. It is ludicrous. Trump, to me, is a clown at best. At worst, he's a dangerous megalomaniac. However, like the proverbial broken clock that gets the time right twice a day, Trump occasionally gets something right. He has the attention span of a gnat, so it doesn't last necessarily. He can contradict it and blow it up the next minute. But the fact that he says he wants to be friends with Russia is a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That doesn't mean that we have to embrace and sanction every aspect of the Russian system, which I certainly don't. I mean, it's not democratic in the way that I'd like to see. But Russia is not a force of malevolence all over the planet. And you know, I'm not sure if I'm proud of this, but I supported Hillary Clinton in the last election. I've been to Russia 7 times in the last 2 years. I was often the only one at conferences in Russia or in various other speaking engagements, I would be the only one of all my Russian colleagues who would be supporting Clinton. They were all supporting Trump. I recently asked a friend of mine who's a top official in the Russian parliament why he and the others supported Trump, who's so reckless and impulsive and untrustworthy and mendacious. And he said, for one reason only, and that's because Trump said he wanted to be friends with Russia. Now the Russians are having second thoughts. Most of my friends there are agreeing that a predictable, rational warmonger like Clinton would probably be better for Russia and the world than Donald Trump. And Trump, as he claims, has been very, very harsh on Russia and has not been acting in Russia's interest. Relations between the U.S. and Russia have actually worsened since Trump took office. The Pentagon now says that the main threat to the United States is no longer international terrorism, it's Russia and China. We've increased sanctions on Russia under Trump. We've increased airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. He tore up the Iran nuclear deal that Russia played a pivotal role in negotiating. He rejected Putin's offer to extend the New START treaty for another 5 years. He's provided lethal aid to Ukraine, which Obama said that it was too reckless to do. He provoked the North Korean crisis before backing down from that one. He's increased America's troop levels in Afghanistan by another 4,000 or 5,000. He expelled scores of diplomats and embassy staffers. He's increased the NATO troops in the Baltics and Eastern Europe. He has actually been terrible. But then he has this friendly meeting with Putin and wants to deny that the Russians meddled in the U.S. election. But overall, Trump has been terrible, and America's relations with Russia have never been worse. We've got these crises, whether it's in Ukraine or in Syria or in the Baltics, that are very, very dangerous, which is why I'm glad they're meeting. I'm glad they're talking. I'm glad they can have another meeting, and I hope that continues.
And this is why this updated chapter to the book is so long, is that so much has been happening, and you're able to go back through. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of this, but we have to take another break. I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with acclaimed historian and author Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We'll continue our conversation after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, who is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Before the break, Peter Kuznick, we were talking about Russia, all things Russia, as seems to be in vogue here in the United States. But you touched on something that Chase had asked about earlier when we were talking about the natural resources and the financial control of these kinds of resources. And of course, Afghanistan is the longest war in U.S. history. It also appears to be one of the ones that goes down the memory hole. One wonders if the corporate media remembers necessarily that we are still involved in wars there. You mentioned Trump had sent more troops there, which called attention to it. It was estimated in 2010 and then updated a few years later that there's maybe about $1 trillion in untapped mineral deposits in Afghanistan. That number has been elevated to potentially $3 trillion. And let's not forget the opium trade, right? But on top of that, we're talking iron, copper, cobalt, gold, lithium. Afghanistan is one of the poorest countries on the planet in terms of the population, but in terms of resource wealth, it's an amazingly rich place. And that's, of course, also why Russia was trying to get in there during the Cold War. So this also plays into the present with U.S. and Russian relations, does it not?
It does. If we go back, Afghanistan is a really interesting case study. Because, first of all, the insight into Afghanistan's mineral riches actually goes back into the late 19th century and the early 20th century. People should look this up because we've known about Afghanistan's mineral wealth for a very, very long time. But Afghanistan has been one of these political footballs that's been used, exploited. That country is dirt poor. When the U.S. got involved, I think the life expectancy was something like 40 years. I mean, this is a country in which the overall majority of people are illiterate. They live in great poverty. It's always number one or two in the corruption index. It's a very depressing country, and we've done almost nothing to help that. In fact, the corruption is not abated at all. Even still, if you want to get a job as a teacher there, you've got to give at least 5 months of your salary in bribes. Get a job as a teacher, and that's not even a well-paying job there in Afghanistan. But if we go back to where this all begins, it's 1979, where you had a pro-Soviet government takes over in Afghanistan. Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to Carter, sees this as a golden opportunity, and the United States begins to throw money there to work with the Saudis in financing an operation that was run largely in Pakistan to train the Mujahideen, to train Islamic extremists, to train jihadis to overthrow the Afghan government. The University of Nebraska was producing the training manuals. The U.S. was arming them. People like Osama bin Laden and other future leaders of al-Qaeda were involved in much of this operation. And the United States was not concerned that the government there was oppressive. In fact, the thing that they objected to, these mujahideen who we were training, the main thing they objected to was that women were being educated under this new government, that this new government had the audacity to educate women. So the people who we were supporting there, training, arming, supporting, The main grievance was that women were being educated. Their second main grievance was that there had been land reform going on. So we create this army, or help create this army, of jihadis, who then go and try to overthrow the pro-Russian government in Afghanistan. When the Russians are forced to intervene to support the government there, they had hesitated, they didn't want to. Brezhnev thought that they could knock it off pretty quickly. They send 100,000 troops there, and they're tied down for a decade. It is a disaster for the Soviet Union. But Brzezinski was elated. He was thrilled. He said that now we've given the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. So, and that's, you know, so on what our public pronouncements were, this is terrible. You know, this is, the Soviets have invaded another country. But behind the scenes, they were elated. And so this is where it begins. But when the U.S. invades Afghanistan in 2001, Putin and Russia were assisting us. They gave us landing rights. They weren't getting militarily involved, but they did nothing to impede the U.S. operation. In fact, they facilitated it, which was essential in terms of the strategic concerns about landing the troops and the weapons. But the United States has been involved there for 17 years, the longest war in American history, and we're losing ground constantly. Now the Taliban controls more than 70% of the country, whereas just a couple of years ago, the percentage they controlled was far, far lower. So the situation is rapidly deteriorating. Trump, while he was running for office, denounced Afghanistan, said he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. What does he do? He doubles down. He sends thousands of more troops into Afghanistan. And so we saw the same thing happen with Obama. Obama tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan and said that he wanted other alternatives, but the hawks who surrounded him, led by Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, David Petraeus, McChrystal, they didn't even give him the other options that he was demanding. And so Obama made the same foolhardy gestures and increased American troop strength over 100,000. Trump has now got it back up to 15,000. And who knows what the next step is going to be there. There is no way we're going to win militarily. Fortunately, we're beginning to negotiate somewhat with the Taliban. That's the only way this is going to ever end. And it's still a miserable situation. 1 year in Afghanistan, the United States spent $100 billion on the military side of the operation and $2 billion on sustainable development. It's a country where people can't read. They have a hard time getting people into the military. They don't know about indoor plumbing, and the illiteracy rates are so high, so the turnover rate is astronomical there.
So, Peter, moments ago you did something very refreshing, which was that you pointed at actual policies that Trump has enacted towards Russia, and all of which that you listed are actually counter to what Russia and Putin, as his puppeteer, would actually want. And so it's very interesting that today's media landscape cares more about how a handshake goes or what his catchphrase towards Putin was in front of the press, as opposed to actually trying to point towards policies where Trump has acted as a puppet of Russia, of which we have seen none. And as you also mentioned earlier, we tend to look through the lens of our corporate media that all of these things that Russia does are not reactions to American policies where we've instigated them, but these are just actions that they are taking as aggressors in a vacuum. So I'm wondering, when you put out the new chapter, will there also be a docuseries that we would be able to see on Netflix or Showtime for that?
Right now, we don't have any plans to do that. That project took a lot out of Oliver. We were working on that for 5 years. We actually produced 12 episodes. If people get the box set, they get two more episodes that we never showed on. They cover the period from 1895, really, to 1940. The Spanish-American War, the overthrow of the popular Aguinaldo forces in the Philippines. The United States becomes a counter-revolutionary force for the first time. It's a slaughter there. But there was an actual debate, at least, then. The 1900 election, Mickey, as you know, McKinley versus versus Bryan, a big issue was, can the United States remain a republic if it becomes an empire? Is our empire and being a republic antithetical and contradictory? And Bryan was right, and we lost our republic. We lost the more progressive democratic aspects as we went down the road to empire.
Peter Kuznick, you end, in fact, the Untold History book with the famous Ben Franklin quip, right? You know, what do we have coming out of the Constitutional Convention? What do we have coming out of these negotiations, right? And Ben Franklin says, a republic if you can keep it.
Yeah, and, if you can keep it. And we haven't. So much of what was positive about this country in terms of democratic principles has been eroded. And Trump is really turning us into a banana republic. I call his supporters banana republicans because the way he behaves is so, again, antithetical to everything this country was ever supposed to stand for in a positive way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too. I want to point out that I know that we've been talking about a lot of things, and some listeners may start to hear a dirge soundtrack. You know what I mean. It's an occupational hazard we have on these topics. But the thing about the Untold History is that there's so many stories. The New Deal, the Four Freedoms, Henry Wallace. There were counter voices, right? David Talbot writes about some of the counter histories in Devil's Chessboard. But once we got through World War II, and once we got into that Cold War mentality, and then we went on permanent wartime economy, that's really when some of those more positive stories are harder to find.
But we've even had examples more recently, people in this country uniting and rising up and challenging the powers that be. And that's another side of the history. It was one of the things that I love so much about Howard Zinn's People's History, is that it's a story of resistance. Howard was very excited about my project with Oliver. He's a good friend, and Oliver and I were both very, very disappointed and saddened that Howard wasn't here to see it when it finally came out. He was a very enthusiastic supporter, and we see our project is very much complementary with what Howard was trying to do. Because the resistance part of it is necessary, but also, Mickey, as you understand as an historian, that the way people view history is very much going to limit and constrain not only what they think about what's going on, but what they can imagine going on. If people think that the way the world has turned out is the only way it could have turned out, and they can't imagine, they can't comprehend, envision a better future, a better society. I mean, the world that we've created, a world armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, a world in which the environment is eroding, which we're dumping toxic waste everywhere, which we're heating up the planet, in which we spend so much human wealth on perfecting the means of killing and destruction instead of the forces that would give people a better life on this planet. You know, that's not the way it should have turned out, and it's not the only way it could have turned out. You mentioned Henry Wallace. Well, he's a great example, and he came within a hair's breadth of becoming president in 1945 instead of Harry Truman. If he had, there would have been no atomic bombings in 1945 and probably no Cold War. We have John Kennedy in 63, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, completely reversed himself on almost every major policy. And he and Khrushchev were working together to end the Cold War, to end the arms race, to pull U.S. troops out of Vietnam, to end the space race. We came very, very close again before the Kennedy assassination and then Khrushchev's being toppled in 64. The first 2 years of the Carter administration were a period when we had some hope again, before Brzezinski and Strauss and the others managed to capture Carter and turn him into a cold warrior who legitimized so many of the very dangerous policies that Ronald Reagan enacted. And those moments come, but we have to be ready. And for people to be ready to seize those moments, they have to understand the history.
Peter Kuznick, I want to come back after this musical break and conclude our conversation, but I want to focus on some of the things that have been going on since 2012 and focus on some of these movements, and perhaps we can talk about some of the things that you might be putting in this new updated version of the Untold History of the United States. We're speaking with historian Professor Peter Kuznick at American University. After this musical break, we will conclude our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we have been speaking with historian and author Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. This is also, of course, a series, a documentary series, and you can learn more at the Untold History website, untoldhistory.com, so you can learn more there. Peter Kuznick, just before the break, you were talking about how history is a weapon and how history is very important for providing context for not only the present, but in terms of what we can imagine and what we can accomplish. And you concluded the first edition, The Untold History, you concluded talking about what was happening in 2011, 2012, when it was Occupy Wall Street. And of course, we saw around the same time we've seen movements for social justice like Black Lives Matter. We've seen in the last couple even movements like Me Too and Time's Up. So these are the very kind of social movements that you were alluding to historically that are happening in the present, correct?
I certainly encouraged by the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie wasn't quite as astute on foreign policy as I would like him to be, but he was a democratic socialist and a proud one. And Bernie was talking about universal health care. And what an absurdity that a country that's as rich as the United States does not have universal health care. We used to be able to say that there were two countries, two advanced industrial countries that didn't have a national health care program. It was the United States and South Africa. But now South Africa does have one. So it's only the United States, the only country. I travel in Europe, I travel all over, and people can't understand why the United States does not have a national health program that represents everybody. But you got a situation here where they're cutting school lunches. Why? So they can fund this latest tax plan giveaway fiasco to the super wealthy who really don't need any more yachts, don't need any more vacation homes. They've got enough already. And that should not be tolerated. And the Occupy movement was really a response to that. The Black Lives Matter movement is a response to other things in the United States. Racism, the militarization of police force, the cavalier denigration of black lives in this country that's gone back to the founding. We sometimes refer to it as America's original sin, but the United States was born in slavery, and racism has been the air we breathe in this country ever since. But there are movements, the Me Too movement, the Sanders campaign really brought together a lot of that. And we've seen other signs recently of candidates who are getting elected who represent much more progressive views. I think that's encouraging. I know that the surveys show that young people think much more positively about socialism than do the older generation. They think more positively about socialism in many surveys than they do about capitalism. There is a lot of signs of progress. But you turn on the media, you turn on the television, and you just see the kind of insanity that we saw in response to the Trump-Putin summit. When John Brennan, the former CIA director, says that Trump's behavior in Helsinki exceeds the threshold for impeachment and is nothing short of treasonous. Well, you know, John Brennan, I don't expect much from. But Anderson Cooper's not an idiot, usually. And he says, you've been watching perhaps one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president at a summit in front of a Russian leader, certainly that I've ever seen. You know, but that was the response that we got across the board to that. John McCain says, no prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant than one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. And what was so disgraceful? That they were trying to ease tensions between the United States and Russia. Yeah, Trump is a fool. And the way he handled himself certainly was counterproductive. And as hopeful as I was about the fact that they were meeting and agreeing about certain things, I was that disappointed by the way Trump handled it, because I knew that what he was doing effectively was uniting the opposition and was going to make it impossible to actually make real progress on any of these issues.
So, Peter, speaking of opposition, and you also just mentioned young voters a moment ago, I believe this next primary will be the first time that millennials are the major voting bloc. So I'm wondering, as things stand today, and not to put you on the spot too much, but as things stand today, do you think that Trump is poised to win re-election? And if not, are there any Democratic or independent candidates that you see that would give him a run for his money?
I can't imagine that this country has sunk so low that it would re-elect a Donald Trump.
Who wasn't technically elected, although through the Electoral College. I mean, so this is
another The Electoral College is another issue. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why this is not a real democracy in any meaningful sense. Even still, there is no excuse whatsoever for Hillary Clinton to lose that election. The Democrats chose the candidate. The one candidate who couldn't beat Donald Trump was Hillary Clinton. When he comes up with his Project Hollywood tape, she's in a position where she can't even use that against him because of Bill Clinton's and her own antics before. I mean, how could she not have exploited that? When, in fact, Trump, who's the most money-grubbing, corrupt, greedy person on the planet, is able to turn the tides on her and accuse her of being in the pocket of Wall Street and make such an issue of her $225,000 speeches for Goldman Sachs. You know, so she, and the greed that she and her husband exhibited, you know, Trump is able to use against her. And the campaign that she ran, you know, it was a completely negative campaign.
The collusion seems to be coming from the Democratic National Committee more so than Russia.
I don't know if it was more collusion, but the Trump people wanted to collude with Russia, but to get as much dirt and any other help they could get against Clinton. I don't know if that meets the legal threshold.
The bigger picture, though, is we know that the DNC was rigging what was happening in the situation, in the primaries, to get a Clinton candidacy.
Absolutely. I mean, the Podesta emails that WikiLeaks put out there were real. Those were his real emails. And it was clear, it was embarrassing, but it was embarrassing because they were making sure that Clinton got the nomination.
Right. And the same group of people that are screaming about collusion with Trump today are the same people who refuse to turn and look inward at the collusion that Hillary Clinton and the DNC did against the Bernie Sanders campaign. So it's very,
exactly,
very interesting.
Are they blaming Russia or are they blaming fake news? I mean, you know, again, you said earlier, Peter Kuznick, it's an amazing time that we live in terms of the layers and the thickness, right? The fog of war and the massive levels of propaganda, misinformation, and disinformation that we've seen. And so I know you're almost finished with your updates, but we're going to have to wrap up here. But you certainly had your work cut out for you. And it sounds to me in a lot of ways that your covering of 2012 to 2018 as an update for the Untold History could be its own book.
Well, there's so much to say. And the thing is, you can't really end this because every day something new and crazy happens. Trump is like nothing we've ever seen before. Now, the positive side, potentially, is that Trump is so different and so, in some ways, he's not beholden to the same Wall Street neocon interests that everybody else has been in recent decades, that it would surprise me, but it wouldn't totally blow my mind if he ended up doing something positive also. So, you know, I think we have to be prepared that maybe he can, in a moment of sanity, do something that we like. And if he does, we have to be ready to support that in terms of relations with Russia. I think we're very close to solving the crisis in Syria. This has gone on for years. And the Russian intervention turned the tide there at a time when it looked like Assad was possibly going to be defeated. And now the Assad government controls 80% of the country. There seems to be a deal in the work. Even the Kurds are talking to Damascus right now. And I think that we are probably within a year of settling the crisis in Syria. Even Netanyahu now says he accepts Assad being the ruler in all of Syria. And I think Trump might do the same. So that would be a good thing. if we can solve one of these crises that we're facing, we have to move on the nuclear front. We haven't really talked about that. The United States and Russia have between us 93% of the world's nuclear weapons. We need to have some deals to extend the New START treaty, for starters, and to maintain the INF treaty. We need to make progress on the climate change front. The United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. Maybe Xi and Putin can talk some sense into Trump on that front also. We've made a little bit of progress in Korea after Trump almost brought us to war there. So there are things that can be done in the short term that I think would be very, very positive.
Well, Peter Kuznick, we're out of time for the program. I want to thank you once again for coming back on the Project Censored Show. And of course, I apologize, we didn't get into one of your big areas of research and interest, and that is the nuclear area. And I know that you go each summer to Japan. Well, I'd love to have you back on the show once you come back, because there's a lot going on there, and you always have a lot of great perspectives to share with us.
Thanks, Mickey. Anytime.
We've been speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University, also co-author of The Untold History of the United States with Oliver Stone. Peter Kuznick, thanks for joining us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm Mickey Huff, your host and executive producer, along with Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers include Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York, and all of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.